discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us for the 47th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink radio show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Okay, guys, we're very sorry we had a technical issue with Dr. Mathis' song for this evening, and so I'm having him cycle his call, and we're
so
having
we
Dr.
Back?
Mathis. Yes, we are back, and I'm having him call back in now, and we're going to try the music thing again. Let's try that again,
okay.
Dr. Mathis, whenever you're ready.
Okay, let me just do a test and see if you can hear this.
Yep, so far.
Is that coming through?
Yep.
Okay.
All right,
here we go.
Let's try.
Take two. The saga continues.
Excited because I actually know what song that is.
Uh-oh.
You know, it's good. Sometimes you have picked stuff that I didn't know, and it's awesome to learn about the new stuff, but I know that that's from Tommy, and that's The Who.
That is correct. The See Me, Feel Me. Yeah. So I thought that was, since we're going to be talking about virtual and online therapy tactics, which are typically known in my business as telemental health, or telepsychiatry or telepsychology or any of another names, I thought it would kind of be a cute little intro to do the see me, feel me thing from that perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and thank you for mentioning that. As Dr. Mathis has pointed out, tonight's episode is going to be entitled Online and Virtual Therapy. But before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so since we've talked about amplifiers the last couple of weeks, I thought I would talk about guitars tonight, since obviously guitars are usually what go through amplifiers, at least when it comes to the world of rock and roll music. And a variety of other forms of music also. But since we're doing the program based on rock music and rock and roll music, I thought I'd do that. So most folks probably know that today's electric guitar has come a really far way from its roots. So back in the day, when dinosaurs ruled the earth in the early 1900s, well, the big band guitar player guys played with these huge big body acoustics, and they couldn't really be heard over the horn section and the string section and the percussion and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, folks were trying desperately to do everything from telephone transmitters and, you know, all kind of crazy stuff to amplify things like guitars and banjos and that sort of thing. And, you know, even some hobbyists, you know, use these carbon button microphones that they attach to the bridge of the acoustic guitar, trying to boost the signal, but they were pretty weak, and so people were experimenting with a lot of things. So electric guitars originally came from that genre so that these folks could be heard playing these hollow-body acoustic guitars. So some of the earliest attempts at that used tungsten pickups. First design for an amplified guitar was with George Beauchamp in 1931, I think, who was one of the general managers of the National Guitar Corporation, which has just become National now, which is still around in various incarnations. And together with Paul Barth, who was the vice president of this company, they did sort of this one-piece body prototype with kind of cast aluminum, and it was dubbed the frying pan because that's kind of what it looked like. It looked like a little frying pan with a really long handle on it. Which was actually built by Harry Watson at the factory, who was the superintendent of the National Guitar Company at the time. And those have sort of morphed into what we call resonators today. So if you see those metal guitars, those Hawaiian-looking things, or some people call them Dobros, but that's actually a company that produces resonators. So the entire line of those kind of guitars, the lap steels and or the ones you wear around your neck, are called resonators, and they're kind of a product of this early thing. So commercial production of these things started in 1932, I think, which was first done by the Electro Patent Instrument Company, who partnered up with Beauchamp and with Adolf Rickenbacker and Paul Barth. And so eventually the Rickenbacker, the Electro Patent Instrument Company, became Rickenbacker, who now makes all these great guitars and who started making them back in the day. So in that year, I think it was 34, 35, Beauchamp applied for a patent in the United States that was issued in 1937. And so all of these flying pan guitars and these different guitars were being put out. And then they started, that sort of morphed into this thing called an Electro Spanish, which was this hollow-body type guitar that was a full 25-inch scale, had 17 frets on the fretboard, and there weren't too many made because people didn't know what the heck to do with them, and they had a really hard time getting folks to try them because they were so used to these acoustic stuff. They're like, you know, what the heck is this stuff, right?
Yeah.
So when people started hearing them, and the jazz guys started hearing them, they're like, oh, hey, you know, I can sort of make, you know, I can be heard on these things. So then people like, you know, Gibson got into the fray, and, you know, Audiovox and Epiphone guitars and a bunch of other manufacturers in 35, 36 started getting into these kind of things and started making all these hollow body electric guitars, which were called Electro-Spanish or Electric Spanish. So when Gibson put them out on market, they were dubbed the ES guitars, which stood for Electro-Spanish. And the model number after the ES, like the 150 or the 145 or the 335 or the 325 or the 275, those were all how much those guitar costs at the time. So when the when Gibson first... Yeah, I know. Yeah, you wish that were the case today, right? So add a couple of zeros onto that bad puppy. So when Gibson put out, excuse me, when Gibson put out the first of these models, which is around 36, 37, the first model they put out was the ES-150, which was $150. And the way they marketed it commercially was they, you know, the marketing ploy was you can get an extra special ES, an extra special guitar for $150, you know, which was like pretty pricey for the day. And it was basically a single coil kind of bar pickup that was originally designed by a man named Walt Fuller, I believe, which later morphed into this model they called the Charlie Christian, because he was the great jazz guitar player that was one of the first people to use this in an orchestra. So from his kind of people seeing him playing it, they're like, oh, maybe that's okay. We can kind of do this kind of thing. So then a bunch of other people kind of got into the fray, and a lot of other folks started playing them. Well, these eventually morphed into a variety of other guitars, which were this, those are the hollow bodies, and you have the semi hollows, which are part hot, part hollow body and part with a piece of wood in the middle to hold the pickups in, which kind of helped some of the feedback for the when they started cranking up the amps, and then eventually, of course, they got into the solid bodies, which was really championed by Les Paul, by the guitar with the same name, obviously, which was around the early 40s, maybe 1940. And then he based his guitar on an Epiphone acoustic electric guitar, acoustic archtop hollow body, because at that time Epiphone was Gibson's biggest competitor. They eventually bought them in the late 60s, but they were a separate company at the time, owned by a Greek family. So the electrics had the advantage of not having so much feedback. So when the rock and roll guys got involved, you know, they were cranking these things up. The hollow bodies and the semi-hollows were feeding back, so they were much more prone to use the solid bodies, whereas folks that were playing for the big band orchestras, like Charlie Christian, who played for Benny Goodman, you know, or T-Bone Walker, some of the blues guys, Big Bill Brunzi, all those folks, Danny Stewart, all those folks used, you know, these big hollow bodies and semi-hollows. So when the solid bodies kind of evolved from that, and Fender was one of the first people to put that out, kind of about the same time Les Paul put out his, for Gibson, put out this Les Paul model. Yeah, what a shock. Well, Fender came out with something much more simplistic with a one pickup model called the Fender Esquire. And it was sort of kind of the antithesis of the hollow body. It didn't have any, and like the Les Paul, didn't have any sound, any hollow parts or sound holes, so it was, you know, no feedback was happening. The Les Paul was a much more elegant-looking guitar than the Esquire, and the Esquire had one kind of single-coil type pickup, where the Les Pauls had these humbuckers, because all of the single-coil pickups that are like in the Fender Esquire, which morphed into the Nocaster, which morphed into the Broadcaster, which morphed into the Telecaster, right? So that's the Telecaster comes from all of these single pickups. Well, by the time they got to the Telecaster, they'd put two pickups in there, but they were still single coils, just like in a Strat. Different single coils, but same principle. Well, the Les Pauls had basically two single coils next to each other, which cut out the hum that's inherently caused by the electrical current going through the single coils, because at the time they didn't have a lot of shielding for the wiring. So you had this coming out of the amps. And so to buck the hum, Les Paul came up with these two picks up side by side, which the magnets sort of cancel each other out, and therefore they were dubbed the hum buckers. That's how the name comes about, for anybody who wanted to know. So from that, of course, everything else has evolved, you know, and from the Les Paul, you know, from the Broadcaster and Telecaster comes the Stratocaster, and then from the Les Paul, Gibson morphs into the SG, you know, which were used by people like Pete Townsend and Angus Young. And then you have, now we have these chambered guitars, which are basically solid bodies with little scooped hollowed parts out of them, like you took an ice cream scoop and kind of scooped some of the wood out. So they have semi-acoustic-esque tones and semi-solid body tones, right? Then you have the semi-hollow bodies and the hollow bodies, which are still being made. And the semis are things like B.B. King's Lucille, which is essentially a chambered body. It's an ES-335 that's been modified, so it's really not a full hollow body or a semi. It's kind of a chamber-esque guitar. Things heavy as hell. But they're still making full hollow bodies and semi-hollow bodies, and Gretsch makes a lot of these. So, you know, folks like Stephen Stills and Billy Duffy of the Cult have these guitars. And, you know, a lot of these have the classic Bigsby vibrato on it, and Bixby was a motorcycle guy who invented the vibrato, did the Bixby vibrato for the guitars because he thought the guitars were kind of cool, like motorcycles and rebellious, and that was the connection between the two. So it was kind of interesting. And then, of course, the acoustics sort of morphed into the acoustic electrics with the piezo pickup in there, which was really championed in the early days by Ovation manufacturers, and then people like Hart and Kansas and Glenn Campbell and Cat Stevens were all using his guitars live because you didn't have to have a mic in front of it, and it wasn't a pain in the patootie to play live. You know, and then of course now we have all these variants of one string guitars, which is also known as a unitar, which a lot of your blues guys, Mississippi blues guys will use, or a four string guitar, which is technically known as a tenor. And I actually saw Paul McCartney playing one of those in a studio session. And then some of the heavy metal thrashy guys are using 7, 8, and 9 strings to get extra bass notes out of them. So a lot of your grunge rock guys and your progressive metals. And, yeah. So, you know, Frederick Thornendale of Meshuggah uses one of those. Trey Gunn, who has played with King Crimson before, had an 8 or a 9 string. And Murky of the Korn band uses that. So, I mean, you've got all these different folks using these things. And then, you know, have manufacturers like PRS guitars and ESP making all these kind of weird dillies, and BC Rich also, who manufactured at one point a 10-string guitar, which had kind of like sympathetic strings, and then of course the 12-string, which is the double string for everyone, and you know those are most notably the guitars that were used by like George Harrison of the Beatles or Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, and some of the folks with the Beach Boys back in the day. And also, you know, those, because they have this kind of jangly kind of sound, which is kind of how the Byrds got their jangle. And Rickenbacker also has a specially wound pickup that they use. So that's kind of a proprietary thing to Rick's, which have this kind of jangle tone. And so it's just very unusual sound you can only get from a Rickenbacker. And, you know, folks like Jimmy Page of Zeppelin have used the 12 string, but usually that's in conjunction with the double neck, which is most often, although not relegated, just to Gibsons. Gibson is the person you see most often with them. And Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin playing the EDS 1275 or, what's his name? Don Felder of the Eagles playing the double neck, right? Alex Lifeson of Rush, right? And Geddy Lee actually has played a double neck Rickenbacker, except one of those was a 12-string and the other was 4-string bass. So there's all these different permutations of them. I think there's actually a double neck that was made for Mike Rutherford of Genesis and Mike and Mechanics that had a double neck during some live shows. So there's been a bunch of people that have used them over the years. They're heavy as heck and kind of ungainly. But if you're wanting to switch between the 6 and the 12 in the middle of a show, you can't be picking guitars up. So that was sort of the answer to that. And, you know, then of course, there's a lot of acoustic 12 strings as well. Leo Kottke being a big 12 string player. So what started out from acoustic guitars, because you couldn't hear them, and, you know, we got to find a way to make these things louder, to the frying pan, which, you know, sort of became the dobro type guitar, the resonator, to you know, the electric guitar to the acoustic electric to the semi-hollow body to the hollow body to everything in between. You know, all this thing started in the early 1900s when all these jazz and classical guys couldn't be heard and big band guys couldn't be heard over the orchestra, and that was sort of the impetus for this thing, you know. What's that saying about need being the mother of invention or whatever? I forget the exact...
Desperation is the mother of industry and necessity is the mother of invention. Yep.
Necessity. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. I was having a brain fart there, which I have quite often, unfortunately. So anyway, that's the origins of our now famous electric guitar with more models and permutations than you can shake a stick at or a Elvis Presley hip at. So there you go.
All right, so thank you for that. Lots of fun. Okay, again, we will be taking calls from listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called Online and Virtual Therapy. With the recent proliferation of computer and internet use and increase in cell phone use in our society, the realm of psychology and counseling has likewise adjusted to meet heretofore unmet needs that these technologies make possible. We are talking about online, by voice or video chat, counseling, as well as other long-distance therapies. Also, we will briefly discuss the use of virtual therapy, not so much online as it is a use of virtual reality in therapy, which has physiological as well as psychological applications. So we will discuss a basic overview of what online and virtual therapies are and enumerating various types. Second, we will discuss the pros and cons of each approach. And third, we will have a discussion about how Dr. Mathis uses these techniques and what services he can provide by this means. I do want to add one further point for consideration. In light of increased media attention on the uptick of suicide news stories from celebrities such as Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, or DJ Avicii, to people like Marco Antonio Munoz, who was a Honduran immigrant forcibly separated from his wife and young son recently, when apprehended illegally crossing the border, and I don't bring this up for the politics. I bring it up to gesture at the myriad headlines flooding us multiple times a week on this very topic. Because of the proliferation of such stories, we will be doing an episode in a couple of weeks that's dedicated to that topic, being suicide. We've talked about it in previous episodes before and also in a general sense, but we're going to hit some specific things next time. It'll probably be either in 2 weeks or in 4 weeks. In the meantime, listeners, get something to write with and grab some mental health resources from our show and share them freely with anyone who needs help. If you miss something, go back to our show as a podcast, replay the segment, or message us by email or on Facebook or on the website, and we will get you the information that you need. And I'm going to check with Dr. Mathis before we get started.
Oh, we're good.
Okay, fabulous. So, first off, we want to talk about a basic overview of what online and virtual therapies are and enumerating various types. So the first one, most basic and obvious, phone and video sessions. The most obvious is psychologists or other mental health professionals who will offer sessions over the phone or on video chat, such as Skype. Several additional online resources listed below are from an article called 8 Online Alternatives That Are Cheaper Than Traditional In-Person Therapy by Gretchen Hintz on a website called themighty.com. This was posted August 18, 2017. There are a variety of different costs, availability, and access considerations, etc. The first one is called 7 Cups of Tea. And that's the number 7, not the word written out. This is an app, an online service focused on emotional health and well-being. You can anonymously connect with trained, quote, active listeners for free or pay to work with a licensed professional. Those interested in helping others can become a listener by completing an online training course designed by Glenn Moriarty, a licensed psychologist and the founder of Seven Cups of Tea. It can run from the website as well as an app for iPhone or Android. And this is at www.7cups.com. And if you want to go straight to the information, then it's /about/howitworks.php. Okay, so the next one is called BetterHelp, and this is written as one word mushed together. Within 24 hours of signing up, you are matched with a trained, licensed counselor who you can instant message, speak with over the phone, or video conference. All methods are included in your membership fee at no additional cost. While face-to-face counseling can cost $150 to $250 for a single session, and this is in real life, not virtually, the cost of counseling through BetterHelp ranges from only $35 to $80 per week for unlimited access to your counselor. In other words, like in the real world, if you go out, you pay $250, you get an hour with somebody once a week. This, you pay your fee once a week, it's quite a bit less, and you have access all the time with all the things. This is also an app-based therapy, and it's at betterhelp.com. Number three, Talkspace. Talkspace is both a website and an app that allows you to connect with licensed therapists in an affordable, anonymous, and virtual way. Talkspace's basic messaging plan is $32 a week and allows one check-in per day. Upgraded plans include such things as live video chat, and that is at Talkspace.com. Number four, Ginger.io offers individual plans based on your needs and regularly monitors your progress. As part of the app, and yes, this is app-based also, you can work with licensed professionals who offer chat times, therapy video sessions, and psychiatric help, depending on what plan you sign up for. Ginger.io begins at $129 a month and is at the website ginger.io. Number five, Wobot. And yes, it's a pun on robot. It's W-O-E-B-O-T. It is a Facebook Messenger chatbot. It's basically a script that exists on Facebook and can message you. It delivers cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Wobot checks in with you daily and creates a chart based on your logged moods. You can try Wobot for free for up to 2 weeks, after which Wobot will cost $39 a month. You can begin messaging Wobot through its Facebook page. Wobot is available on Facebook Messenger, iPhones and iPads, and Android devices. It's at Facebook, and the page is drwoebot, Dr. Wobot, or wobot.io. Number six, Sibly, S-I-B-L-Y, is an app messaging platform that aims to help you achieve your goals through active listening, insightful questions, cognitive behavioral exercises, and other strategies. After an initial inventory, you are matched with a team of 4 to 6 Sibly coaches who are trained in active reflective listening and motivational interviewing. Sibly costs $12.45 a week, and that is available at Sibly, S-I-B-L-Y, .co, not .com. Number seven, iPrevail, and that's written in the style like iPhone, is both a website and an app that provides anonymous online and peer counseling services where you can anonymously message trained listeners. Speaking with trained listeners is free. Paid subscriptions are available for $9.99 per month for those who wish to speak with a licensed professional, and that's at iPrevail.com. And last, number eight, Lantern is a web platform and also an app designed based on cognitive behavioral therapy also. You can take a preliminary quiz to determine which program will suit you best, after which you are paired with a coach for one-on-one messaging. Lantern costs $49 a month, and you can cancel at any time. And they are at golantern.com. And before we get to the next part, I'm going to take a quick break and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, before we go on to the virtual reality stuff.
No, you're good. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's online therapy. The other type we want to talk about is VRT, virtual reality therapy. It's also been called virtual reality immersion therapy, VRIT, simulation for therapy, SFT, virtual reality exposure therapy, VRET, and computerized CBT, CCBT. A lot of acronyms going on. Is the use of virtual reality technology for psychological or occupational therapy, phobias, PTSD, and similar uses. It is widely used as an alternative form of exposure therapy, in which patients interact with harmless virtual representations of traumatic stimuli in order to reduce fear responses. It has proven to be especially effective at treating PTSD, by the way. Virtual reality therapy has also been used to help stroke patients regain muscle control, to treat other disorders such as body dysmorphia, and to improve social skills in those diagnosed with autism. Unlike traditional cognitive behavior therapy, VR-based treatment may involve adjusting the virtual environment, such as, for example, adding controlled intensity, smells, or adding and adjusting vibrations, and allowing the clinician to determine the triggers and triggering levels for each patient's reaction. VR-based therapy systems may allow replaying virtual scenes with or without adjustment to habituate the patient to such environments. Virtual reality therapy was pioneered and originally termed by Max North in 1995 in Atlanta, and the source for some of this data is from Wikipedia. And I'm going to check in with you again, Dr. Mathis, before the next section.
Yeah, a lot of the VRT stuff has been used with Afghan veterans, and a lot of that stuff has been pioneered with or sort of test-driven, if you will, vis-a-vis the VA. So, and they've used a lot of that here in Atlanta.
Yes. We are actually going to cover that again, and thank you for mentioning that. That is one of the reasons that a lot of virtual and online therapy is used in situations such as people in the military who need help before they can come home. And this is really good for that.
Yep.
So the next section will actually cover that and many other aspects. It's a discussion about the pros and cons of each approach. So the first part, since we talked about phone and video first, we'll go over the pros and cons of that. So the pros of using the online approach. Number one, many people live in areas where a mental health professional who is qualified to meet their needs does not exist. Pretty much everywhere has somebody, but they're not always a good fit. Or the person is not available due to schedule, cost, not on your insurance, or whatever. B, many people have a personal schedule that is horrendous for booking appointments. They have shift work, they're unable to take off work for appointments, and et cetera. C, many people have other obligations that are hard to delegate, like child care or elder care, for example. Sometimes there are people who have a senile parent at home, and going out for an hour without somebody there to help could come home to a burned down house, for all I know. D, many people have other extenuating reasons why a traditional office appointment is difficult. They are, for whatever reason, unable to drive. They may be immunocompromised because of other stuff going on with them, for example. E, many people feel a sense of confidentiality, safety, and detachment in processing things online or even on the phone or video chat that doing in person makes them anxious about. A facade or not, being online or on the phone gives a sense of a wall up, just in case things get too uncomfy. One can hang up or log off a lot more easily than walking out of an office. Now, one shouldn't, but it is the illusion of that escape plan that can coax some people to use these services. Some online counseling can be anonymized, whereas actual professional therapy, and you know, by a licensed person, never is, even online. One also won't risk running into someone they know, seeing them going to therapy when they do it online, if this matters to them. You know, some people have had moments where they're in a big enough town where they walk to the office building and their neighbor or their coworker sees them going in and out, and they don't want people up in their business. So online therapy doesn't expose you to that. Number F, or letter F. Typically, online or phone sessions are cheaper than traditional in-office therapy, which makes it the perfect stopgap for many who cannot afford regular therapy, especially in cases where, without these options, they wouldn't be going to anyone at all. G, many online resources allow more contact than for just an hour once a week, as is typical with traditional office visits. H, there's often less of a wait time before beginning to receive help, which in some cases of distress can be critical. I, some patients are so socially anxious that it prevents them from being willing to come to an office, but online therapy is perceived as far less risky. There are a couple additional pros to this approach that apply to the professionals themselves. A, it's a good way to increase availability and caseload. B, it helps you to be providing additional services and learning new skills. And C, depending on one's office costs and situation, it wouldn't require one to be in a physical office to provide help. Some of the cons of this approach. A, context. Sometimes therapists notice nonverbal cues and behaviors that may get lost when not observed in person. This is better in video therapy, but still not the same. B, online therapy alone is rarely enough help to make significant long-term progress by itself. It can provide significant relief and progress, but should not be considered sufficient to merit not coming into a traditional office visit eventually. C, ability and credentials. Unlike traditional therapy, the non-professional or peer counseling, because it is frequently anonymous, gives no opportunity for one to review the counselor or their qualifications, to get reviews from others, etc., as one would in a traditional setting. One question to ask when using anonymous online service is, what mechanic is there for me to avoid having someone again that really did not work out for me, for whatever reason that is? D, here are a few psychological therapeutic approaches that are difficult or nearly impossible to conduct online. One, animal-assisted psychotherapy. Two, art therapy. Three, drama therapy. Four, expressive arts therapy. Five, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, EMDR. Six, music therapy. And seven, play therapy. D, an extra con for professionals. Typically, one will earn less than an office visit, although many who use this method would just not have come at all to the office in the first place for various reasons. This is the next part, E, is not from the list. This is an article on online psychotherapy, and it mentions all of these things in the article. It's kind of an overview of quite a few aspects, so I'm going to read the chunks that I pulled out for you guys. And this is called The Pros and Cons of Therapy via Skype or FaceTime. It was posted July 31st, back in 2013, by Stephen Rideboard, R-E-I-D-B-O-R-D, M-D, of Sacramento Street Psychiatry, and this was posted on psychologytoday.com. And here are some clips relevant to tonight's topic. Telepsychiatry, and here's that term again that Dr. Mathis mentioned earlier, a variant of it, is clinical evaluation and psychiatric treatment at a distance. It brings a specialist expertise to otherwise inaccessible populations in prisons, military settings, and distant rural communities. Introduced decades ago, it is perhaps the most successful example of the more general field of telemedicine. Telepsychiatry traditionally treats patients at supervised sites and makes use of secure, special-purpose video conferencing equipment. Online psychotherapy is usually conducted as part of a private practice without institutional oversight or standardization. The patient is typically at home or work, not in a supervised setting. Off-the-shelf consumer technology such as Skype or FaceTime are often employed, potentially running afoul of HIPAA privacy regulations. And perhaps more crucially, the patients are higher functioning with more subtle problems that demand nuanced discussion and finessed interventions. Psychotherapy by telephone remains extremely popular, often serving as a temporary substitute for in-person sessions, for crisis intervention between regular sessions, and to maintain a therapeutic relationship when one party moves out of the area. Early efforts to use the internet as a medium for psychotherapy seem to take a step backward with text-only channels such as email or chat. In contrast to a phone conversation, text chatting hides vocal prosody and other paralinguistic features, obscuring irony, double meanings, and simple subtleties. Email shares these shortcomings and is also asynchronous. In other words, the conversation doesn't happen in real time. Computer-mediated psychotherapy most commonly takes place online over video conferencing apps such as Skype and FaceTime. These tools are readily available for free and are easy to set up and use. Controversy exists over whether Skype and FaceTime are HIPAA compliant, although there is a strong argument that cell phone conversations with patients, not to mention unsecured email, are far more vulnerable to privacy breaches. Skype and FaceTime feeds are encrypted by default, whereas cell phone calls and email are not. Psychotherapy at a distance precludes smelling alcohol on the patient's breath, noticing auditory and visual subtleties such as a quiet sigh or dilated pupils. Micromomentary facial expressions implicated in unconscious personal interpersonal communication may be overlooked. And to underscore the obvious, the therapeutic frame may be harder to maintain when the patient is in swimmer by the pool and drinking an alcoholic beverage during the session. The potential for patient acting out, including with suicidal threats or gestures, can render an online therapist especially helpless and possibly more easily manipulated than his or her counterpart in an office setting. And I'm going to check in with you real quick, Dr. Mathis, before we get to the virtual part.
I don't know. I've got a bunch of stuff I could say. I don't know where you want me to chime in here, but...
Ed, anything you want to talk about the phone and online things I've mentioned just now?
Okay. Yeah, generally, if you're going to do this kind of stuff, there's certain clients you want to not do this with and certain clients that's easier to do this kind of stuff with on a safer bounds. You know, you always want to make sure if you have folks at risk that you have resources in the community that you're working in that you can refer them to, like their personal physician or an emergency room at a hospital or whatever, when you're working with potentially suicidal or drug abusing kind of clients. There are just so many things you have to cover if you're working with a group of folks on a regular basis. And your best bet is to, you know, connect with the community that you're going to be working in and have some real-time folks there who can pick up the slack in case the proverbial feces at the rotating blades and, you know, you're sitting there and the client hangs up on you and you're going to kind of go, oh, my God, you know, you can call some folks to do some, you know, on-site stuff. That's always very, 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 very helpful. And, you know, hopefully if you're going to do this, you're going to use a secure internet thing like WebEx or something that is HIPAA compliant, that is very, very secure. You want to, you know, warn the person on the other end to do likewise and to have adequate video cameras so you can see things like expressions on the person's face, which you can't see via the phone, and that you have adequate lighting. And, I mean, there's just a plethora of issues that need to be considered, you know, and if you're going to do this on a regular basis, in lieu of going in, let's say you've got a room in your house you're using to do this, you know, you want to make sure that the room is appropriately decored and you're not going to get interrupted by dogs or kids or, you know, whatever. And you need to kind of warn the person on the other side, hey, you need to, you know, carve out the time, go by yourself, get in a room where you're not going to be interrupted, where people are going to overhear you. So there's all these things you have to attend to prior than even starting this kind of thing, screening the person to make sure that the person you're dealing with is in fact the person you're seeing by getting, you know, some sort of verification vis-a-vis credit cards or driver's license or whatever. I mean, there's just so many things that you have to do if you're going to do this on a regular basis. And that's one thing, you know, if you've got a regular client that you're working with and then they're on vacation in some place and they want to do a couple of check-ins with you, that's a very different thing than if you're running a full-time online telemental health practice. That's a very, very different scenario. So for those folks who are wanting to do that full-time, there's just a bunch of stuff you have to take into consideration if you're going to do therapy, not the least of which is checking in with the state's requirements for do you have to be licensed in that state if you're seeing the client in that state. And some states require you to do that, and some states don't. Some states have you can practice X number of days in our state without a license. We'll kind of courtesy let you practice here, providing you have a license and good standing in another state. So there's just a bunch of stuff you have to consider. APA right now is in the process of trying to get a sort of what I'm going to call a carte blanche sort of across the border certification for people that they can pass certain hurdles and, you know, get certain training or pass certain tests and basically be able to practice across state borders telemental health without being licensed in every state you're practicing in. So that would be a really good thing to do, because that thing could get very, very pricey doing that, obviously. But regardless of what you do, if you're going to be dealing with folks in a certain arena, your best bet is, you know, to check with all the legal and ethical, you know, ramifications of practicing in that state, because the state that the client is in is considered the home base, if you will. So if you're in Georgia and you're seeing somebody in South Carolina, you better be checking with the South Carolina regs to see if they require you to be licensed in that state to do online telemental health therapy. So it's just all this, you know, rigmarole you have to go through if you're going to do this on a regular basis. You just have to be careful. And ultimately, if I were going to go in certain communities, particularly underserved communities, which are, you know, a lot of these places that, like in Alaska or some places in Montana, Wyoming, where folks can't get to a regular therapist, or in some of the Native American reservations or whatever, you know, this could be a really good thing. But if you're working with a specialized population, then you also need to understand the population, the culture of the people you're working with. So there's just a lot of things that go on here other than just, let me just pick the phone up and do therapy with these people, or let me just, you know, get a website and go, woohoo. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you got to be careful with, you know, and make sure that you are giving quality service and that you're protecting the folks you're dealing with. You're not dealing with, you know, folks that are not really, for lack of a better term, manageable efficaciously through telemental health. And there's certain folks that I would, you know, like schizophrenics, I would not see doing telemental health. Folks who are actively suicidal or actively homicidal, I would probably not see doing telemental health. Because, I mean, you have no guarantees. I mean, not that you have any guarantees, you know, here either, but there, it's more of a risk. And it's not something I would want to do. So there's just a plethora of things. You know, we're covering sort of the surface here for folks, just to kind of give them an introduction. But if you're a clinician thinking of doing this as opposed to doing, let's say, consultation or coaching or whatever, and even if you're doing that, you know, you want to use the best practices available to ensure best delivery of services and protection and betterment of the client you're serving, because ultimately that's why we're doing this, right? Well, we should be ultimately, that's why we're doing this. So.
Yeah. Okay. That's totally fair. So let's go ahead and talk about virtual reality therapy pros and cons. So the first one, pros of using this approach. So the obvious advantage to virtual reality therapy is that often situations and tools that either don't exist in reality or are not readily available, for example, such as a phobia of live animals or bugs, can be experienced by the patient this way. B, scenarios can be completely customized to the patient's needs. Sessions can be stopped, rerun, or changed without the drama one would have from processing issues in the real world and affecting other people not involved. C, in some situations, therapy can be provided by experts not physically located near the patient, although usually a doctor or other professional is present to monitor and adjust the experience. Cons to this approach. A, this may require highly specialized equipment and is only available in limited areas. Sometimes the patient would need to perform the experience on-site with the doctor physically present. B, as of the current day, this type of equipment, while not completely out of the reach of many therapists, is expensive and runs a significant investment. For example, there's a company called Virtually Better that makes such equipment, which runs about $6,000 up front plus a monthly licensing fee. And C, exposure therapy works very well for some people, but there are also many people who do not respond to it. And I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything we want to talk about with virtual therapy before we go to the next section.
No, I mean, the same caveats with this go with anything else. You got to match it to the right people, and you got to have experienced people doing it if you want it to be maximally effective, particularly with the virtual reality stuff, because you're often dealing with folks who are very traumatized, because that's what it's mostly used with, is phobias and trauma stuff. And, you know, you just have to be really good at screening folks. You have to have folks that are very skilled clinicians doing this. And generally speaking, this is done in an institutional setting. The online therapy stuff, the telemental health, a lot of that's done out of hospital settings where the patient actually has to go to a hospital and hooks up long distance with another clinician. That's the supervised, what a supervised site is. An unsupervised site is a therapist or clinician doing this in his or her home with another person in their home. So that's the two versions of that. And if, obviously, the person is in a hospital setting, if the proverbial feces of the rotating blades, it's a lot easier to do damage control there than if the person's in their house and things go awry. So,
yes. All righty. So the next section I want to talk about is how Dr. Mathis uses these techniques and what services he can provide by this means. So the first thing I want to say, I want to be upfront with our listeners. Tonight we have provided a wide variety of resources for obtaining online or virtual therapy. Please do bear in mind that Dr. Mathis does actively provide video and phone chat sessions for patients. And naturally, we want to encourage our listeners to consider using his services. And you may contact him through our Facebook page, which has his direct office contact information, as well as through the website, rockandrollshrink.com, and it has a page set up for booking online appointments. And while we primarily hope you will come to him for help, most of all, we want to see people get the help that works for them as soon as possible. So we have also highlighted alternative services for consideration. I don't want you guys to think like, you know, what are you doing taking business away from yourself? In the end, we want you guys to get the help you need. So
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
please feel free to consider whatever works. Go ahead.
Yeah, ultimately, this show is about opening people up to what they need. It's not about putting feathers in my cap or anybody else's cap that runs the show or associated with the show. So if people want to, you know, do consultations with me or whatever, that's fine. But they also need to be, and I'm glad you did that they need to be aware of all this other stuff, because there's no one-size-fits-all for folks, pocketbook-wise or stylistic-wise or need-wise or anything else. So the whole purpose of this is really for folks to get whatever it is they need from whoever it is they need it. And I really encourage people to do that. Find the best fit for you. I don't give a flip who it is or what through medium it is. Get something that fits for you and use it. I don't care what it is, as long as it's healthy, obviously.
Yes.
And that's what I want for folks.
Excellent. So the second thing I want to talk about is what you can provide as far as these sorts of things go and techniques that you might use that may be a better fit than some of the things we've mentioned. I know that you have some expertise that a lot of your peers simply do not. And that's part of why we do this show. A lot of times you'll talk about stuff your peers won't. You have opinions that are not very popular, but do make a lot of sense. You raise a lot of really good questions. And, you know, so let's talk about that a little bit as far as these sorts of things go, because I know you do offer that.
Yeah, I am probably the best fit for somebody who's looking for an atypical, non-normal type of therapy person who is very well grounded in cognitive behavioral, rational emotive, reality therapy, and Adlerian type therapy stuff. I'm not a Freudian. I don't claim to be. I'm not a Jungian. I don't claim to be. And while I may use those concepts and I may, you know, steal from those people, let's just be honest, as well as borrow from folks like, you know, Carl Rogers in some cases, I am predominantly a cognitive behavioral, rational emotive, reality therapy, Adler therapy guy. I kind of mesh those four together because they all have a lot of similarities in common. First and foremost, getting people to take utter and total responsibility for everything they think, do, and feel, period. No excuses, no blame, no pity party, no whatever. And that's not for everybody. So I'm really good with folks who are ready to dig in and belly up to the bar of reality and deal with their shit up front. No questions, no excuses, and do it. I'm really good with adolescents and young adults because I'm very blunt. And I don't weave fairy stories. I don't muck around. But I also don't infantilize them. You know, and I give teenagers as much respect as they're willing to earn and as they're willing to demonstrate to me and other folks. And I just assume out of the box that those folks are competent, respectful people, and I try to treat them accordingly unless I have reason to do otherwise. So that's the stuff that I'm really good at. And then I also use some pretty non-traditional approaches, like using my music-assisted therapy program, which I want to make sure that everybody understands it is not music therapy. I am not a music therapist, and I want people to clearly hear that. My form of this is called music-assisted therapy, which uses music as an assist to talk about issues, and it's a thing that I've patented and yada, yada, yada. So folks who have a real interest in that or for whom music plays a part in their life, I'm probably a good match for them, right? I'll also occasionally bring in video stuff and bibliotherapy stuff. So I'll bring in like poetry or short stories or whatever to use if that's important for the client. So, I mean, I have a pretty good literacy level in terms of both, in a variety of the arts, not just music, but in classical literature and, you know, this sort of thing. So, and movies, because basically I'm just a movie junkie, predominantly because a lot of movies have what I call take-home points. So I'll often use those as references for folks to look at more complicated issues and to ground more complicated issues, like a scene from a famous movie that most people have seen. So again, if that's kind of your shtick, then I'm a good match for you. If you're looking for very traditional psychoanalytic psychodynamic therapy, I'm not going to be a good match for you. If you're looking to wallow in your childhood crap, and I'm not suggesting that you have childhood stuff that needs to be looked at because it's been very traumatic and you're trying to let go of the trauma and you're having a hard time, that's a different issue. There are people who just, and I mean no disrespect to these folks, who just like to wallow in their pity party. You know, and it's kind of like I have a buddy in Vancouver who has a saying that I steal from him quite frequently, which is, I have some cheese to go with that whine.
No.
I don't do whining really well. So it's one thing if somebody comes in and they're hurting and they've had some bad breaks and they've had some bad stuff happen to them. I'm all about being empathetic and you know, trying to help them and nurture them and support them. What I'm not about is allowing them to wallow in it, because that's not doing them a service. Now, some folks have to have a period of grieving, absolutely, but they have to be grieving with a goal in mind, which is to get over the grieving, to use the grief as life lessons and to turn something bad into something good, to transform it, to take the energy and redirect it and to claim the energy and the power that I believe every single person on the planet has the ability to do. And I really mean that. So folks who want to be powerful and take their power back, as you've heard me say many times on the show, I'm the guy for that. If you're just wanting somebody to pat you on the buttocks and say, poor baby, go see somebody else. I suck at that. I really do. I'm horrible at that. I really am. Cool. If you want somebody to acquiesce to your BS, I'm horrible at that. If you don't want somebody to call you on your BS, I'm horrible at that. So don't see me. I typically don't work very well with folks who have whatever issue they have and they don't want to address it. In general, I tend to work very, very poorly and don't see folks that have severe cases of autistic spectrum disorders, dementias of any kind, or who are younger than 10 years old. I just don't work well with those folks. And so I refer them to folks who are just awesome, 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 and I'm not. folks who are clearly delusional and who don't want to not be delusional. So if you have a psychotic disorder of any kind and you don't really, you're wanting to hold on to the psychotic delusional belief system and you don't really want to take your meds or you don't really want to do the work or whatever, go see somebody else. I'm not your guy. I just suck with that. Yeah. And in general, I suck with people who don't want to grow to begin with. So if you're coming in and you're looking to blame everybody and be a victim, I'm not your guy. I'm just not. You know, and I know my limits and I know what I suck at. And I don't want people coming in that I'm going to provide shitty services to, because that's not what I do.
Fair. All right. Also, I'm going to emphasize something that I happen to know, which is a more related to the actual topic this evening. When you do the online or the video services, I know that you tend to run a very late schedule because of a sleep disorder. We've talked about it on the show before. Well,
ooh,
the nice
yeah.
advantage about yeah, the advantage of this is, you know, if you're feeling like you need to talk and it's 3 a.m, you know, you can get on your phone and do a little app, but you also can talk to a licensed professional who may actually help you make some really meaty progress. And the apps and things that we described tonight are very good, but you all need to understand that they should be viewed as kind of plan B. They're good for a stopgap. They're good to get your feet wet. If you kind of don't know where you're going with this, maybe you can kind of talk it through with some of these peer people, and that may help you out. If you do it through somebody like Dr. Mathis, you are going to get the full battery of all their training and their, you know, certificates and the things that they specialize in. And these are licensed people, which is also why it's not done anonymously, because, you know, HIPAA things, you have to verify who you're talking to and who you're talking with.
And what I would say is, folks who are going to use any service whatsoever, ask what are, you know, what's the person you're chatting with? What is his or her, what are his or her credentials? What are his or her specialty areas? What gives this person authority, if you will, about where's the body of knowledge coming from? Right. So they've taken a you know, highly advanced 6-week class and you know how to do online therapy. Do they have multiple degrees and certifications and or licenses? You know, find out the credentials of the people that you're chatting with, because otherwise just go hang out with a buddy you trust and ask them. I mean, and I don't mean to slam anybody, but the whole purpose of reaching out to help is to get somebody who is supposedly more informationally laden than you are. And if they're not, what the hell are you spending your time and money for? That just makes no sense to me.
Well, actually, I have an answer for that that's not even rhetorical. A lot of these services came up because, to be really blunt and put a really fine point on it, there are people out there who don't really have a buddy to go sit with and talk, or their phobias or issues are causing them to not be able to do it, or they're worried about what their friends will think because they know them.
Right.
And, oh, my God, you're going to find out that I want to sleep with my teacher or whatever. I don't, you know.
Right. Well,
and so that helps.
Well, and as you know, one of the other things I do is I'm like one of the only guys in town, probably the only guy in town who makes house calls, you know, and who works almost every Saturday and almost every Sunday. So this is the beauty. If you're embarrassed to come to a doctor's office, you don't want to come to a therapist's office, you want me to come to you and you're in town, I'll drive to you. I mean, it, you know, it's more pricey, but I'll come to you, you know, have DSM will travel, And so that's the other thing. I offer services to folks who can afford them. And I mean, no disrespect to folks. You know, if you've got the money and you're willing to pay me to come to your place, I've done it for a lot of people, or people are having a moment and they're too, you know, upset to drive, or they're too drunk or stoned or whatever. And they say, hey, you know I got an appointment, or, hey, I'd like to come see you, but I'm just so out of it. You know what? If you're making the rational decision not to drive, I want to reinforce you for that. I'll come to you. Okay, I got it. You know, that's being rational and safe. You're not driving drunk. Woohoo for you. Like, that's a smart choice. If you're too freaked out or upset to drive, you don't trust yourself, hey, that's a smart choice. Call me, and if I can come to you, I will. I mean, you know, and that's why I do live services and, you know, make house calls, and because I deal with a fairly volatile population when I do in-person stuff. And when you do that, you know, you got to expect some of those emergency calls. You got to expect some of those late night things. And the one good thing about my sleep disorders, I'm up till like 5 every morning. So most people aren't having, you know, meltdowns at 6 at night, or, you know, 3 in the afternoon, or just after dinner. They're having them later at night. And I'm like, where are the dancing women? I'm like ready to go. So it's not like, oh, my God, I'm about to go. Oh, you woke me out of a deep sleep. Oh, hell no. My brain is, like, ready to party. So, yeah.
Now let me ask you this, as far as going back to the, you know, the online or the video stuff.
Right.
How do you feel about things that people would be missing from a traditional type arena? Like, when you do these, you don't have body language or tics or, you know, sarcasm or, you know, things like that, the in-person cues. You know, how do you deal with that?
Well, you do have video. You know, I do video stuff when I do this kind of stuff, so I do get some of that. But you do have to be, in the words of one of my heroes, that way, careful. You're hunting nonverbal communication. So you have to really be careful. You have to be careful when you're a sarcastic son of a biscuit eater like I am. You have to be very careful and use humor very sparingly. And usually with people who don't know me that well, I'm very careful about what I do with that kind of thing. And I tend to be much more traditional in the way that I come across with folks, and I don't do any bad puns like I usually do with people who know me. It's just, you know, you have to be careful with that kind of stuff. Obviously, if you're doing things online, it makes psychological testing a whole lot harder. Now, there are some tests that are now available where the clinician, if he or she has the credentials, the test maker and provider have these online things, and what you do is you buy a subscription to their services. They send your client an email. The client responds to the email, logs into the site, takes the test online. They score it, and then they send you the results. Now, that's not quite as good as me doing it myself, but it's certainly better than nothing. And as you know, I'm a huge proponent of testing, so I know exactly what I'm dealing with. And there are some companies that are offering that now, because that was a really big, from my mind, that was a huge, huge negative of any kind of phone or online or telemental health of any variety you want to call. You don't have testing up front. You don't know what you're dealing with. And as you know, everybody walks in my office, gets a long intake interview and baseline testing. And I require that. I want to know what the heck I'm dealing with. So there's companies now that will offer that, certain tests online for you to do that. And they send it to their stuff, and they score it, and they send you the results, and you share it with the client. So that's a really cool thing. That's something that has recently popped up in the last year or two. So that's a good thing. And the other thing I would say to any clinicians who are considering doing this kind of thing, that if you're going to do it, make sure you get training in some of this. Make sure you at least, you know, get some baseline stuff. There's a company in California called the Telemental Health Institute that's headed by Dr. Marlene Mayhew, who is just a really stellar person. Herself as a person is just, I love her. She's awesome. But clinically, she's very solid. She has great stuff. She's been a big pioneer in this. There's a book she's gotten written, co-authored with several other people, called A Practitioner's Guide to Telemental Health. So, you know, get this stuff, get some online training, get some live training from whomever, American Telemental Health Society or whatever. You know, get yourself out there and get educated. A lot of the stuff that you use in your office, you can transfer to the telemental health field, but you got to morph it a little bit. And there's some nuances, as you mentioned, there's some nuances that you have to adjust for and take into account when you're doing this over the internet or on the phone or whatever. So you have to be, you know, you just have to be up on this stuff and learning how to morph the skill sets you already have into this arena.
Got it. Okay. That is the extent of my notes. So I'm going to check in with you one more time and see if there's anything about other parts of the stuff we've talked about that you want to go back to, or any last words on that sort of thing.
I would just say, you know, investigate what's out there if you're a user or potential, you know, curious about using it or thinking about using it. Look at everything that's out there. Don't just go with the first thing you see. Find out the credentials of the people doing it, the training they've had. Find something or someone that clicks with you and go with it regardless. You know, the consumer has to feel good with what he or she is getting, and it has to feel like the person is clicking with them. And if they're not clicking with you, no foul on either of you. You know, it's just some chemicals mix and play well together and some chemicals don't. This is just like any other relationship. And I would say the same thing to people in live therapy. If you sign, you know, you show up for a couple of sessions and you and the therapist aren't clicking, find somebody else. No foul on the therapist, no foul on you. It's just not a good match. The chemistry isn't right. Find somebody the chemistry is right with. Same thing with this kind of thing. But make sure that when you do get whatever version of this you want, that you're using people who have secure sites, that they're not just using Johnny Come Lately, you know, Chuck U. Farley video conferencing or whatever, and that the folks are, that the folks, to steal a line from Cheech and Chong, that the folks aren't, you know, just fly-by-night folks that got a three-week training and they threw them on the phones or whatever. Just be careful. That's all I'm saying. You know, find what works for you in your pocketbook, because these things vary dramatically in cost, and, you know, folks who are clinically trained and licensed and certified, they aren't cheap. You're not going to get them much cheaper than you will in person. So you're not going to be saving a shoot ton of money, but you will be saving getting out of your house and going. Or if you're in a place where you can't get out of your house because of your condition, or you live in a, you know, a place that isn't easily accessible to resources, then, hey, you know, you're saving a long trip and money, gas money and time and whatever. So that's something you are saving on. But, you know, my opinion on this is you get what you pay for. And if you're paying $10 a month, I mean, come on, guys and gals. How good can the service be? I'm not slamming anybody, but come on, really? You know, you want a Cadillac and you can only afford a Volkswagen, and no offense to either of those car manufacturers, because Volkswagen makes real good stuff, but they aren't Cadillacs, they aren't Rolls Royces, they aren't Bentleys, they're not Teslas, you know, and no offense to any of those people. It's just, come on, let's get real here. So that's my last word.
Okay, good. And, you know, and it is a fair point what you raise. You know, you're going to get what you pay for. We do want to see you guys get help. If that is, I mean, if all you have is a little Chevy Cavalier in the backyard, you know, drive it out, get a job with it, save your money and get the caddy later, but get out and do something. You know, some of these are peer to peer. Yeah. Some people don't have a buddy they can sit and talk with. Maybe sometimes some people are in therapy because of their buddy and they can't really talk to them about it. you know, whatever the situation is. So, you know, these resources are out there. But do understand, you know, we're recommending them because sometimes it is better than nothing, but it's not better than the best. So get what you can manage and get going. That's more important than doing nothing. And
yes,
that's
ma'am.
The most important takeaway that we hope you guys take from this. So
absolutely.
With that, it is after midnight, and this will wrap up our show on online and virtual therapy. So we hope our listeners have a better understanding about these two techniques and how they're different from traditional office visits, and see if you have some resources where you can use this if a traditional situation is not good for you. And so on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank you guys for listening this evening, and also show appreciation to those of you who are joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. On Wednesday, June 27th, again at 11 p.m. EDT, for a new topic brought to you right here on blogtalkradio.com. So please look for us on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on iTunes and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. So good night, everybody, and rock on.